accession number 9420, reel 3.
Mr. Bill Gilman, Reel 3. We were talking about how you got on with the other ranks. How did you get on with the officers in the 3rd Battalion?
I had no problem with them. I never had, anyway. And I found them, in a good many cases, were quite new themselves because of the casualties, apparently, we were suffering. And while I wasn't aware of that as a reason, a lot of these youngsters had passed out of their training school as their OTCs and be given their commissions. And normally speaking, you had a variation of them according to the temperament of the individual. And some were a bit arrogant and thought they were generals and colonels before even they were first lieutenants. And others were quite sensible chaps and they acted accordingly. They weren't irksome, in other words.
Did you think they were competent from what you saw of them during training?
Yes, as far as they are. No, I think with hindsight, I would say that they had received very short training themselves because they were new. They were handling us carefully in some cases. As I say, in other cases, according to the nature of the individual, they just acted accordingly with authority and treated their authority either with arrogance or with sensible, attitude towards the youngsters. And we were all green. The people who really carried us through were always the non-commissioned officers who'd had previous war experience, been over there, come back and were teaching us and gave us a lot of wise advice as to what to look for and what to dodge.
Did you respect the officers? Did you think they...
Yes, well, I did. I can only speak from my angle. And I think, generally speaking, it was such a new world for all of us. The pace was so rapid that we accepted what came along because of its newness, if I can put it that way. It was something that you couldn't fault because you couldn't compare it with any other circumstances or people. But by and large, I think they did a fair job to cope with what was to them quite a new world also, if I can put it that way.
What about kit inspections? Did you have that?
Kit inspections were very, very efficient and thorough. And you had to look after your stuff because you must appreciate that after all that time, and this was in the latter part of the war, we were getting short of material. It was very dear. It was costing lives to bring here. And, of course, we never have been a self-supporting nation. We've had to rely on the goods and materials being brought. And, of course, as you know, most of the stuff that was uniforms and clothes for the troops and the forces of either service had to be made at our own factories. And therefore, of course, we had to be careful because of the shortage of material and the cost of it being brought over. And because of that, we had to be very careful about looking after our stuff and making sure that it wasn't nicked by anybody else who'd lost theirs. This was the game that you had to watch. It was a hit-and-miss game there. You had to have eyes like hawks and make sure that you check everything and... And also, you had to be very tidy. The discipline was good. I liked it. I thought there was a good reason for it. And it was the reason I accepted it. And if I'm satisfied that the thing is fair and efficient and necessary, I've always accepted it. That's been my attitude to life always.
What about the lack of privacy of army lifestyle? What did that affect you?
No, there wasn't any need for it, really. I mean, these... You were either careless in the way you handled yourself, or you were careful, you know, and you acted accordingly. You didn't get any false modesty, let me put it that way, because you couldn't do it. Under the circumstances, you were there, and the different mode of living from being at home, it was a different life, and you accepted the shortcomings, if you got any sense, and if you hadn't, you were a constant bloody grumbler. And this is what some of them were. You always get these misfits, or I call them misfit, probably because I've accepted everything that's come along and made the best of it.
Now I think we'll go on to the actual training, right? You know, that you did while you were at Blackdown. Firstly, drill, basic drill. How were you trained in that? Marching drill.
Oh, it was drill. It was square, barrack square stuff. From the foot drill and so forth. It was very intensive. No one was spared. You just had to do just what you were told and not mess about. And the route marches, of course, that country down there at Blackdown and all round by Salisbury was all adaptable to that kind of thing. And
could you tell me what you do on a route march? What was the sort of...
Well, you just march and march until the officer in charge deems it time that you had a break, and you've got a 10-minute break in which you just eased your pack off of your shoulders, because you always had a full pack with your army overcoat inside it, with your mess tins and the hard rations, and it was a full fighting kit you were forced to wear, and your ammunition pouches and belts and bayonet and a rifle. And of course in those days we used to form fours, not form threes like they do now. And you had to carry that lot, and it was designed, I think, to toughen you, which it had to be, because this is what you were going out to encounter. And it was valuable from that angle, but it was very exhausting. And you just didn't want to do anything. Those who smoked just had time for a puff, 10 minutes, and then on again, press on. And the time was never altered, and you just had to, once you got there, you didn't get any transport back. You had to march back in the same way.
But how far would you go?
Oh, 4 or 5 miles there, and another 4 or 5 miles back again. It varied according to the routine of the day and what was all planned out.
Would people drop out ever of route marches?
Sometimes, some of them did. Their feet wouldn't take it. And, of course, they were just simply arranged for, and they did something about that. I don't know what they did, and we didn't care either. We didn't worry about it as it fell out. And I found that throughout the war in action. You'd never never stop to help anybody. You just pressed on, and this was the rule. You forward, advance, this is the thing.
What about...
Until you got shoved back again.
Did you do any singing? Or
while you... Oh, yes, you all sang on the marches.
What sort of things did you sing?
Oh, yeah, the old stuff, you know, Pack Up Your Troubles and Tipperary. They were the favourites, you know, and then they'd make up their own... stories, words to fit the popular songs, you know, and the usual things. Have you seen the Sergeant Major? We know where he is, sort of business, you know, under the old apple tree and all this kind of thing. You had to do this. This was a sort of self-morale boosting that you gave yourself, and there was always some wit there. There was always somebody who'd start something, and somebody who'd start a song, and that was it. It was taken up immediately. It was the old British spirit. I mean, I'm proud of being a Britisher. I mean, I'd fight the Germans even at 86 as I am now. I'd take up a gun if we were threatened. I've got no time for these bloody people who shout peace, peace, peace all the time and don't even know what the meaning of self-defence means. I mean, this is to me, it just doesn't make sense. It's not British in my idea. I don't know whether I'm a British fanatic, but blimey, I'm not taking that. I think we're as good a country as any in the world, and this is, you've got to be prepared to fight for that because of that.
What about other aspects of training? What about your rifle shooting and maintenance?
Well, we had the old Lee Enfields at that time, and it wasn't like in the last World War where there was wooden. We had wooden things, and you know, at the beginning in the Home Guard, and well, that's another story. But in the main, the Lee Enfields were rather a good job. They were accurate, but they were heavy, very heavy rifles. And of course, the tendency has been throughout the military history to lighten the weight of weapons, hand weapons, and it's got to a fine art now. The way I understand that present modern day small arms is being half devoted towards plastic butts and all this kind of thing. It's out of this world compared with what we had. I mean, you had a butt trap, a brass butt trap on the end of those rifles there, because I mean I used one of those on the front when I got to France, because you could stick your upend them, you could fix your bayonet, dig it in the ground, open your butt track, and put a corner of your Lewis gun in it. I fired at Jerry planes through using those.
We'll come to that. Well, were you taught how to maintain your rifle?
Oh, yes. That was the holy of holies. Your rifle was your best friend. That's what we were taught from the word go. And you had to keep it clean, and they were inspected at every drill on every day. Examine, you know, port arms so that you could, the officer could look down, and you put your thumb behind down to where you put the aperture, the bullet always was fired from, and you could look down the barrel and you could see your thumbnail, and if you could see your thumbnail and it was clear, then you could see the sides of the rifle too. It was all shiny, but it showed up the slightest bit of dirt that was there.
How did you clean your rifle?
With the pull-through. We had it was cotton or wool of some kind. No, it wasn't. It was a piece of flannel. And it was about 2 inches long and half an inch wide. And also, you could get some oil and oil that. It had a long cord on the end with a little bit of metal, like a nail on the end. You drop it through the barrel and then pull it right through, and that cleaned the barrel, as clean as a whistle. You could see the rifling inside the barrel, and there was no difficulty about that at all. But that was a real must, and I think everybody observed it, because there was heavy penalties. If you got caught with a dirty rifle, you were in trouble.
And where did you keep the pull-through? Were they still keeping them in the butt?
In the butt trap, yes. There was plenty of room in the butt trap. They were very well made, those rifles were. And as I say, they opened easily with a cutout. You know, get your thumbnail under it, open it, and it worked very quickly.
How about the actual shooting? How were you taught to shoot?
On the range. Yes, we had some good ranges there. We used to take turns, some of us, so we were selected. I think they used to take a mental note of who was a bit careful in what they did, because you weren't allowed at the other end where they were shooting at, and you were putting the targets up and dropping them down, because there was a big deep trench at the target end, and then you had the other fellas at the end shooting, and you used to hold the targets up, and you used to have to send a message through phone through sometimes what the scoring was from whichever section was firing and the different positions. It was very interesting. I used to enjoy that. And a good many of us took turns in it, you know, firing. I used to like firing. I got my marksmanship. That was across guns.
How did they teach you to shoot, though? What sort of things did they... Were you allowed to shoot as you liked, or was there a set method by which...
Oh, no, it was all a routine job. It was all organised, and there were the round targets with the inner and outer and bulls and all this. And then there was the figures, you know, with the cut-out figures of bodies, you know. And they were fired at, and they had a sort of a circle on the hearts part and used to fire at that and all that.
But I mean, was there a set method by which you fired? Did you have to fire in a certain way?
Oh yes, yes, yes. You were either tire single firing or rapid fire, in which you fired, you know, a clip of five or something like that. Because I think that's as far as the Enfields took. They only took five, I think, in a clip. And
what about?
They were good bolt rifles, of course they were. You know, you use a bolt. You lifted it up, pulled it back. That extracted the empty cartridge, and you slip another, or the other one, next one would go in, you see, and you push a bolt forward and you're ready to fire. Safety catch was a very important item that you had to watch. Always put your safety catch on when you finish firing. And all intermittent times, as long as you've got ammunition there and all that.
Were there any tips they gave you about how to shoot accurately?
Oh, yes, yes. Of course, you had to adjust. You fired by sighting on your sights. You could move your sights according to the length of range. And also, the basic of firing comfortably is to press it hard into your shoulder to take the rebuff, the recoil. And you didn't feel anything, especially if you were strong, got a big shoulder like I had. I never used to feel any trouble with it. You could feel the thud against your shoulder when you fired, but if you didn't hold your butt against your shoulder, it'd kick you, it'd come back and hit you, give you a hefty and bruise your shoulder. You soon got wise to that, you know. You didn't want many bruises of that kind because the kick was so surprising. And of course now they got recoilless small arms and they take their own kick. But with rifles, it's always the same. You get that kick. You can't avoid it. But no, they didn't at that time know how to cope with it.
How did you?
And then, of course, we did grenade throwing as well.
How did you improve your own shooting? I mean, why do you think you became a marksman when others didn't?
Well, you got used to making sure your sights were right. Your sight. It was only about that long, and it was about that thick, just about the size of it, and it was about that height. And it was marked for ranges, you see, of so many yards. And it was 100 yards, 100, 200 yards, or 300 yards. You put your sights on accordingly. And you judge by your first shot how your sights were, if you were not thinking about what you were doing. Someone used to just get rid of them and they didn't kill a bugger whether they scored a bull or whether they went off the target even, which some of them did. And I mean, it takes getting used to, and if you care and you watch it, you know, you think about what you're doing, you used to get decent results. And of course then you became a marksman because you were able to get results.
Were you proud of that when you got your
marksman? Oh yes, yes. It's a certificate of efficiency, and that's how I looked at it. Same as when I was a Lewis gunner, I got me L with a lit group of laurel wreath, you see, and round it.
Now, you mentioned bayonet drill. Could you tell me how
you trained? Yes, I used to hang the sacks up then on the great big wooden frame and fill them with hard straw. And then you got the order yelling charge, and you used to have to stick your bayonet right into this sack. It was to get used to plunging them into somebody's body, you see. And that's the way you handled it. And you had to yell with it and all that. That didn't appeal to me much. I thought it was a bit of an act going on, you know, to making yourself like kids having a game, you know, and all this. It didn't appeal to me much at all. But you had to do it, and if you didn't, you were asked why. What are you up to, you know? Which was right. I mean, you were taught to do that, and it was in order to try and prepare you for what might happen, and which did in fact really happen on the front. You see, there was hand-to-hand fighting, and the only hand-to-hand fighting I had was in Valenciennes, I only had a revolver then.
We'll get to that. Were you taught any method of bayonet fighting, you know, actual drill? Or were you just...
No, it was just the normal routine action. There was no variation in bayonet fighting. There's only one method of bayonet fighting. That is, get to the objective and shove your bayonet in as hard as you could.
So you weren't taught any of the defensive measures and...
No, nothing of that. Crikey, no, there was no time for that, I don't think. I think the...
Did you do a lot of bayonet drill?
No, you had certain days in the week when you had bayonet drill. And, of course, you knew what was going to happen, and, of course, it was always the same. There was no variation in it at all. And
Did the bayonet instructors make it out as an important part of fighting?
The only thing that the variation, you're saying that was there a question of defensive, yes. The only one I remember was when you got to the stage where you couldn't use the bayonet, but you were taught to hoist your rifle at the other end and then use the butt for knocking an opponent out if you got the chance to do it. But that was the only thing that I can remember that we were taught.
Well, did you see bayonet fighting as an important part of the training and what would happen to you on the Western Front? Did the instructors?
No. No, it just was a must that had to be part of the routine because there was very little hand-to-hand fighting. You know, so far as the actual action was concerned, there was so much of the grenade stuff lobbing.
We'll come to that now then. Bombing. How were you taught bombing?
Well, you were in an enclosure where you had a wooden fence right around you, a very stout wooden fence. And then you were in groups of six with an NCO in charge, an old sweat, who told you, because you'd previously had your pin drill before you...
What was a pin drill?
Well, you had to pull a pin out of a grenade, and they were all Millses. We had no other kind of grenade. They were good, they were fragmentation explosions, and they were very accurate, and I never saw any failures of any that failed to go off, which is a tribute to those who made them, of course. And, of course, you had to learn then to keep your head down. And when you threw it, you didn't take silly liberties and start running about with a grenade in your hand, especially when you'd drawn the pin out. Because when you'd drawn the pin out, the pin held the lever down at the side, which contacted the detonator. And once that lever flew up, the detonator was ready, had started into action. And there was so many seconds before it actually exploded and caused the grenade to explode. And it used to be fun, really, because you'd see how far you could throw them. You know, you threw them like a cricket ball overhand. And then you'd duck down, you'd wait for the explosion. Sometimes we used to peer over the top to see what they looked like when they went off. I did, anyway. I was always curious about
You were in this enclosure as cover. Were you also there to give you practice at throwing it straight up? I mean...
No. You never threw it straight up.
No, I mean, because in a trench, you can't throw straight because of the top of the trench.
No, but it was just about the same height as the trench was. The trenches were very seldom more than 6 feet high. It might be 6'6", all depends. Some of us tall ones had to keep our heads down more. But normally the shorter ones was well protected, and that was about the height of the bomb throwing structure.
Were there any accidents while you were there?
No, only just one or two were dropped sometimes quickly, and then the old NCO always used to be on the alert for that, or if any one of us was there, you picked the bloody thing up and slung it over and down you went, you know, straight away, because you knew it was going to explode nearer to you. But you usually had time. You know, unless the bloody thing rolled, then it was panic stricken. But normally, it didn't. You know, it was you're all in the bay together, and it couldn't roll very far, so you had time to pick it up and sling it.
Did you ever actually have to do that?
No. I was all ready for it, because I anticipated. You always thought, oh, blimey, if he drops this, you know, you'd get some kids that were scared stiff to you know, it's the attitude of the individual to these things, you see. If he knows he's got a weapon in his head that's like to go off bang and blow his bloody head off or something like that, then he's more careful. And sometimes, if he's that type of individual, he gets scared, and, you know, about a thing might go off before it goes there so many seconds. This is a sort of psychological effect it has on some people.
What about gas? Were you given any training at wearing
your
respirator?
Oh, yes, we had thorough gas training. That was a must, because there had been gas attacks. In fact, I was in two of them. And mainly...
How did you train, though, for it?
Used to go through a gas chamber where they released the gas, and you had to go through it with your masks on, you see, and then walk through it and come out at the other end.
How long was it? How far would you walk?
About a length of a hut. And they were quite successful, and you came out just like, you know, washing your face and drying yourself. You know, it was quite a routine. Nothing ever happened or seemed to happen. If anything happened, we were never told.
Did it give you confidence in the masks?
Oh, yes, yes, rather. You knew you were going by, especially the tear gas. Now, that, if you some of them, you know, got a leaky mask perhaps here and there, you'd see them coming out with their eyes watering, you know. And sometimes you'd catch a whiff of it when you came out, through the curtains, you see, and then you'd feel your eyes start smarting, and then you'd know it was the real Mackay, you see. And we were always taught, because it's geraniums. Now, be careful of geraniums, that's chlorine gas, see. And
what
if
about
you smelt geraniums, that's what I had in my experience later on.
What about phosgene, mustard gas? Would you practice for those?
Yes. Yeah. All the same gases that were used by us and the Germans were used in our mask practices and exercises. They were very, very keen about that.
Were the masks comfortable to wear?
Yes. Yes, and you had one, you know, to fit you, because everybody's face is not the same.
Did you practice anything to do with the trenches, either digging them or maintaining them or just living in them?
No.
While you were there?
No, we were provided with the trench, I forget what they called it now, trench shovels or trench...
Entrenching tools.
Entrenching tools, yes. And we were taught how to use them, but he didn't need much teaching to tell you how to dig up ground with what you'd got. We thought it was a bit flimsy, but anyway, it...
What, the tool was?
Or? Yes, it was just a matter of gouging out holes to stick that, get down a bit lower or lower. Yeah.
But you weren't taken around a model of trench, you know, a recreation of what the trenches would be like?
No, we were taught about that in lessons and lectures and on illustrations, you know. Slides and all that we were told. And of course we all knew from the news on the newspapers that you form the trenches took.
What else would you have lectures about?
Oh, anything that was in connection with preserving your life, you know, and taking care of yourself and keeping your head down, making sure that you wore a helmet and didn't think that your head was hard enough to take any stray bullets or anything like that. Of course, some of them were a bit careless, but the more precautions you took, the safer you were, obviously, especially from snipers, which is what we found eventually.